Well, good morning and welcome to the Wayne Eddy Affair on your radio station. This is KYMN out of Northfield, Minnesota, the home of cows, colleges, and contentment. Have an interesting guest here this morning. But before we get started, it's been a busy morning for me. I was kind of disappointed when President Trump signed that deal that he did last weekend, because I was hoping that nothing was done, and they shut down the federal government, and then you send your taxes in, and then when they get all those tax returns, once they get back into place, they're going to be so busy, they're just going to ignore everything. That was number one on my deal. Also, I heard Terry and Jeff talk about Leonard Nimoy's birthday was today. And if you ever want to check something out, back in 1981, the program In Search Of came to town and filmed In Search Of Jesse James. And if you want to see that, just go to YouTube, put in the keywords In Search Of Jesse James, Leonard Nimoy, and check it out. It's a pretty interesting program. 1981 that was filmed, and it starred Northfielders. So you want to check that out, all right? Leonard Nimoy, In Search Of Jesse James. Well, it's time to get going here as we look at our guest from across the way here. He's going to pull that microphone nice and close to him so we can hear him. And I got to say, welcome back, Mr. Marino. Good to see you, sir.
Great to see you, Wayne.
You know, I was thinking about you all weekend every time I drove through town, because we have a mutual friend, Howard.
I was just going to say, it must be Howard.
Yep. And
I think he should be mayor.
Well, years ago, yeah. Oh, boy, you talk about bleeps.
Yeah, he and I both have that problem.
years ago, when the late Dallas Haas had the Archer House and several apartment buildings and homes, he was always busy. And the sure sign of spring was when Dallas Haas took his snowplow off of his yellow old pickup. Then you knew spring is here. He's got the plow off.
But Howie's not back yet, is he?
Well, that's what I was going to
say. Yeah, we've got to keep an eye out for him.
They got a big sign there saying, I'll see you next spring.
Okay.
And spring's, a week old now, approximately?
Yeah.
So when that sign comes down, then we know spring is really here.
That's right, yeah.
Gordon Marino is my guest, and he is a philosophy professor at St. Olaf College. I think, have you been here twice?
Yeah, my third time.
And I know we never get done, but I can't.
We're always sparring with each other about something.
Well, that's good, isn't it?
That's very good.
But you know those kidney punches. And I had one. I told you about it, and you said, well, you're lucky you got back up.
It's the liver shots that are dangerous.
Is that it? Okay.
Kidney punches are illegal.
Okay, it must have been a liver shot. I went to the ground, and I was explaining, folks, to Gordon, who's a professional when it comes to boxing, that I had worked in a shoe store with a skinny guy, but he was a tough guy, and he was a Golden Glover or whatever. And I said, well, how come when they're in, they're kind of like they have their arms around each other, they keep hitting each other in the lower back? And he says, well, that's a liver punch, and it hurts. And I said, oh, he said, yeah, and he popped me, and I went right to the floor, and my eyes were watering, and I mean, it hurt, and he hardly hit me. He just knew exactly where to hit me.
Yeah, but also it's because you didn't see it coming, so you couldn't prepare for it. You couldn't roll with it, so the big thing is to see the punch coming.
All right.
And that's what made Ali so great, is he could see all the shots coming, so he would always turn with them.
You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting some great boxers, Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier.
My favorite.
George Foreman.
Another one of my favorites.
And the great White Hope from Minnesota.
Yeah.
The one who knocked Howard Cosell's toupee off of him. We're both in the same boat here.
I know. I just also... Dwayne... No, not Dwayne Bobic. The other guy. Oh, man. It'll come back to me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He just died a couple years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, he passed away.
Yeah.
But, you know, the interesting thing for me was, as I mentioned before, and by the way, if I'm duplicitous, nice word, huh?
Very good, yeah.
You don't have to say, well, as I told you last time, Wayne, because we have new listeners, you know, all the time we're getting more and more listeners, so they haven't heard all the stories, and I want to do a thumbnail sketch, too. But when you say boxer, boxing coach, philosopher, it just doesn't, you know, like, oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I asked you last time, and I'm still going to continue asking it, is that philosophers have philosophies, correct?
Yeah.
And a philosophy is a way of living, or...
Philosophy is a love of, philosophos in Greek means love of wisdom, right? And I always like to distinguish that between a love of knowledge. So I think of wisdom in terms of how to live, you know, so it's not just this theoretical knowledge. It's something different. So we have love of wisdom versus love of knowledge, and philosophy is love of wisdom.
Now, in today's language, would that be college educated and street smarts?
Something like that, yeah. It would certainly involve how to, not just kind of abstract theories and everything, right, and abstract knowledge, but about how to live, how to be a good person. Yeah. And the great Seneca said that if you study with a philosopher and you don't come back and prove it every day, then you're wasting your time. And he didn't mean by that smarter. He meant like a better person.
Okay. Now, who are some of the great philosophers? I think Aristotle.
Yeah, sure.
Socrates.
Plato. So you have Socrates was Plato's teacher, and Plato was Aristotle's teacher. How's that for a three?
Well,
How's that for a teaching triumvirate?
That still continues today, doesn't it? That most philosophy majors end up being teachers of philosophy?
Most people who get a philosophy PhD in philosophy, they want to become philosophy professors. There's not much else to do with that. But an undergraduate degree in philosophy is very useful. A lot of people want to hire, because you have analytic skills, you can write, think clearly. So it's when you get the PhD in philosophy that either you hope to be online for a job as a professor.
And Gordon Marino, I think last time we were talking, I mentioned that there's nothing else to do except become a professor if you have a PhD. And I think you corrected me and said that corporations are hiring people that have majored in philosophy.
Yes, because they have a good skill set for analytics, very strong analytic skills, can generally communicate. Yeah. So it's not the crazy degree or impractical degree that everyone thinks it is.
All right. Well, I'm going to pretend that I'm a freshman at St. Olaf. Or does your class require more experience to take philosophy?
No. I teach first-year students.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be that first-year student that just barely got in, okay? So I'm going to ask questions about different things. It fascinates me, but I don't have the discipline to study it, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when a freshman comes into your class and that big word, philosophy, do most of them really know what that is?
No, they don't. Very few had a philosophy class in school. They've heard the term, like, you know. But they're also some people think of it in terms of an avenue to something deeper in life too. So there's a desire for something deeper in life, and so some students are looking to philosophy for that. I think especially in a secular age where some people have lost their faith, you know, and they still want to believe that there's something deeper in life, and so they turn to philosophy.
And so, what does that freshman do when he first comes into your class? Do you give an outline the first several classes on who were philosophers and what they had accomplished or written or whatever?
You try to give them a background in the history of philosophy, as though sometimes it's called the great conversation, because, you know, Socrates will take up a topic and then his student Plato will say something about it and then Aristotle, and it goes on. And so it's almost like this conversation that's gone on for 2,000 years.
Can you help me out and do it?
What do you mean, like...
Well, tell me about what's going on and on between the teacher teaching the teacher, etc. Can you give
Okay, so for example, some of the people that Socrates confronted believe that... So Socrates thought a lot about what justice is, right? What does it be to live a just life? The Greek word is dikaiosune, and So there were people that he argued with that said, look, the just life is to do what comes naturally, and what comes naturally is to take care of your family and others. So the best thing is to appear just, right, in front of the law, right, and do whatever you can to get over, right? To appear just and act on what the law would say was unjustly, right? Because the right thing to do is to just take care of your own and your family, and it's right because it's natural. And so Socrates will argue against that position.
But what would he say against it?
So one of the things he says is that the just life is a balanced soul, and that when you live it like that is just trying to accumulate riches and take care of people, you know, take care of your family, accumulate things, that you just become this endless barrel of desires with holes in it, and that you can never fill up. So Socrates says that the happiest person is the person with a balanced soul, and that, you know, he even argues it's better to be someone who's persecuted for being unjust who is just than it is to be a person who's seems just and is unjust. Right?
I get it. Okay.
Yeah, so it's very powerful stuff. Okay. So Aristotle will take a little bit more practical view of things. Aristotle's more practical.
No good deed goes unpunished. Is that part of the whole philosophy?
That's an outlook on life, right?
Yeah,
that many times we'll do things that don't rebound to our best in our best short-term interests.
Yes, and then it turns into something sour. It's 14 minutes after 9 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN. Today, by the way, is Monday. It is the first day of spring break for St. Olaf College. It is March 26th. The year is 2018. And my guest this morning is Gordon Marino. Anybody ever call you doctor?
Yeah, my students call me Doc.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I tell them, don't call me Gordon, because I try to keep that certain kind of... maintain a certain kind of authority. I said, don't call me Gordon. You can call me Doc. You can call me Professor Marino, but don't call me Gordon, because a lot of the times there's a tendency for people in our society to pretend like, hey, we're all the same. We're all at the same level. And I don't play that with my students.
Well, I'm older than you are. But
not much.
well, the point is that it was Aunt Adair, Aunt Evelyn, Aunt June, Uncle Dick, Uncle Bob, Uncle Clyde, and no way could we call our aunts and uncles by their first name.
Right, or your mom or dad.
Oh, your mom and dad, that, you know. I like it when the little kids show or something like that, and somebody will ask a little kid, what's your mother's name? They go, Mom. So I get that part of it. So I'm still a freshman in your new class.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, boy, this is going to require a lot of reading and paperwork to interpret what I've read?
No, it's going to require – I'm sorry, my friend, but it's going to require short readings, but you're going to have to read them over and over again. So are you prepared for that, Wayne?
Do you mean because I won't get it the first time?
Yeah, that's right. So philosophy is to some extent the art of thinking slowly, and it's particularly difficult in this society, I think, because we're so used to everything being so fast, social media, right? That's really quite a it's like stretching a muscle for students today, much more so than even 30 years ago, you know, because they're so used to everything being quick, and they just wonder, what's the main idea? Just tell me the main idea as if the details didn't matter.
Weren't those called cliff notes in our era?
Yeah, and the cliff notes today would be regarded as too much. If you look back at cliff notes, compared to what students... Today it's called spark notes they read.
Okay.
Cliff notes were much more extensive.
Well, Gordon, I'm glad that you have them call you doctor or call you Mr. Marino. I think that's healthy to do that. It shows respect. And there's so little of it nowadays, I think, in the age of the millennials or whatever. So if you take this social media that you're probably familiar with, almost you have to be. But where does philosophy come into play when people read their text messages or their email messages that have no hand movement, no facial movement, no tone in the voice? It's just there in words, and you have to interpret it. And paranoid people interpret it as a diss, for lack of another word, and other people that know the sender would say read it as maybe a compliment. Do you think that that really harbors inattention to philosophy of life?
No, but I think it's a really good point you make about email, is you can't. This tone is so important in what we're saying, right? We can say the same thing and say it in two different tones. It means two different things, right? And that's completely lost on email. And I also, there's a bunch of people who might be right down the hall from you, and rather than come and talk to you about things, they'll send you an email. So it's, I find it troubling a lot. And even get on the telephone, getting on the telephone is people don't do that anymore. They send you an email and, you're right. You're right. You can't tell what the tone of it is a lot of times. So they're easy to misinterpret.
So
then they have all these emoticons now. Do you know about those?
What?
Emoticons.
Emoticon. I know of an emoji.
Emoji. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Emojis. Right. And they're extremely like hieroglyphics now. People use them all the time. Hundreds and hundreds of them. You know.
Well, you know, I was looking at those the other day, and I asked a younger person, considerably younger, does each one of these faces mean different things?
Yeah.
And they said, yeah. I said, well, there's like 100 of them there. And some of them are so almost identical.
Yeah.
Who interprets that? I do the thumbs up, and I do the okay sign, and I'll do a smiley face, and that's about, I use the cowboy hat and sunglasses.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's about.
They're like hieroglyphics, though, aren't they? I have people that send me like emojis, and what are you talking about?
Yeah, I have somebody that can send like 8 of them in a row, and it's a message.
Right. Right.
And I'm going, okay. So we have established then that is it more difficult than, or have we established that it may be more difficult to teach your course in philosophy than it would have been 2 decades, 4 decades ago?
I think so for the most part. But again, there's a real thirst. There is also a genuine thirst for that kind of thinking. You know, young people want it. They want a new vocabulary to think about their inner life. And that's one of the reasons, you know, I wrote this book that I have coming out on April 24th from HarperCollins. It's called The Existentialist Survival Guide. And it's about an attempt to distill, you know, at least, you know, one message from these philosophers I've been hanging around with for 30 years. It's a very clear message. So I think there's quite a thirst. There's quite a hunger for that kind of thinking, you know, in an age where all they have is technology and, you know, so.
Where's that going to be released or introduced?
HarperCollins. It'll be there's going to be a reading on May 17th at Content Bookstore.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's going
to
do
again,
the reading?
So the topics in the book are, the first few chapters are, and it's filled with personal stories, some of which we've talked about, anxiety, depression, death, love, faith. And one of the group of philosophers that I spend the most time with are existentialists, and in particular, Søren Kierkegaard.
Can we back up a little bit?
Sure.
Existentialism. Okay, teach me what is that?
Okay, so these are a group of thinkers focus on the individual, on choice, on the issue of freedom, on the meaning of life, right? So not so rationalistic as some of the other philosophers, right? So they address the emotions, and one of the things that I found very important in them is that it seems to me that in order to be a good person, you really need to be able to be kind and loving, even when things are going bad, and things are going to go bad in life, right? Even when you're going filled with anxiety or depression, you know, that we all go through. It's just a given, rough times. And these people are really, these existentialists address those emotions in ways that others don't, right? The meaning of them.
Would it have anything to do with psychology or psychiatry?
Well, actually, I think one of the reasons people are attracted to it is psychology today is very, or clinical psychology is often very reductionistic in the sense of, well, you have anxiety, here's a pill, right? No attempt to understand what the anxiety means, or you're depressed, oh, take a pill, right? And these thinkers reflect a lot on what those feelings mean, and how to sit with them. And oddly enough, I think they're more attractive today than they were some time ago because of clinical psychology today is often just about medication and these short-term fixes. So there's a real hunger for that kind of thinking.
Gordon Marino is my guest here this morning. I just did something, and I have to ask you if you ever seen it in a student's eyes. Do you ever see a student's eyes kind of go blank, like, what the hell is he talking about? I just did that.
You should raise your hand and say, okay, here's a lot of students. They don't speak up in class, and I tell them, okay, if you're nervous about doing it, then just try to say, raise your hand and say, hey, Doc, could you clarify that last point?
I just did that.
Good.
Whatever you're saying.
Existentialism.
Yeah. And I just was thinking, I wonder if you could see that in my eyes. And I thought, well, just ask.
Now, your eyes are always bright and curious looking.
Gordon Marino, my guest on KYMN, a philosopher, professor at St. Olaf College, and a boxing coach and a former boxer.
Yep.
And we're going to cover all kinds of things here. But first of all, I have to remind everybody about a fellow named Dale Finger. You know Dale Finger, don't you, Coach? Can I call you Coach?
Sure.
Okay.
You call me that all the time, yeah.
Quarterback Club?
Dale Finger? Yeah,
you've been there.
Oh, many times.
Yeah. What's your favorite thing?
Quarterback Club? I go there for pancakes.
Oh, yeah. Their breakfasts are great. They go till 10 o'clock each morning.
Yeah.
And that means you have 37 minutes to get to the Quarterback Club and enjoy their breakfast. It could be pancakes, waffles, bacon and eggs, hash browns, cereal, malted meal, you name it, they got it. But don't forget they have takeout orders, too. I know a lot of people that work in various places around town will call in orders for a bunch of people.
Oh, yeah.
Then come and get it, and they get a box, and they carry it out, and they have flame-broiled burgers in there and chicken. And the Quarterback Club, locally owned, locally managed. Why not spend your money with somebody who spends their money on employees in Northfield? High school students get their starts there. It's a great place to go.
It is.
Quarterback Club.
Nice atmosphere.
Yeah, I like it.
Generations there. Everybody's all different generations.
And they have their coffee clutches, and you know, guys get together and have their coffee in the morning.
And you don't have to buy a newspaper because the newspaper's there.
Yeah.
If there's a
I got to get you to write these commercials. Heck of a deal. So we're talking about philosophy, and once again, Gordon has been my guest. I can call you Gordon, right?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay. He's been my guest on two occasions, and we just are all over the place.
But one other thing, Scott Ledoux is the guy we were thinking of.
Who?
Scott Ledoux.
Thank you. Isn't it funny how that just pops up?
It's funny. I went like this, and Scott Ledoux came up.
Okay. And if you don't know who Scott Ledoux was, he passed away recently, but he was pretty decent boxer.
Oh, he was really good. Heavyweight contender for the title.
I was going to say he fought some of the big names back in the 70s and 80s.
Up from the Iron Range.
And and he was very kind-hearted.
Yeah.
A very nice man. He would make appearances at nonprofit things just to be able to say, hey, I shook hands with the guy that punched Muhammad Ali in the face.
My son sparred with him once.
Really?
Yeah. It was when Scott was in his 50s, I guess, and was up in the cities, and Scott said, oh, don't worry, I'll take it easy on him. My kid came out of there. He goes, he had a headache for a couple of days. And not because Scott was rough, because he had what you call heavy hands. So even if he's hitting you lightly, a lot of impact. You know, it's like, it was like, man, it was quite an experience.
How long would a guy like me last in with a guy 30 years old that's been in boxing all of his life?
About
a second?
Yeah, maybe.
Now, do you think, are boxers good street fighters?
Yeah, mostly, yeah, because they're also comfortable in violence. Part of street fighting is being comfortable in violence, so they'd be pretty good street fights, yeah.
Okay, I often wondered because you see the movies where there's the tough street guy and then there's the boxer and the street, the hero of the movie is a tough street guy that goes nice, but he's able to beat up a boxer.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, you know, a boxer can see things coming.
Yeah. And again, they're comfortable in violence. That's part of, like, I'm training, I'm taking guys to Faribault tonight. You know, I have one guy who's getting ready for his first amateur bout, and one of the issues in the beginning is just this. No matter how much they train, they get so tired because they have so much adrenaline flowing. So I try to get them to spar as much as they can before their first fight, so they get used to just that rush of adrenaline, which is just makes you tired very quickly.
Yeah.
And so I take them to different gyms. But tonight we're going to Faribault.
To prison?
No, there's a new gym there that I'm working with.
And then just sparring?
Yeah, but just sparring is the same. So you're in a ring, and you're in a ring, and the other person's trying to take your head off. It's the same as an amateur bout.
But is it like open to the public, or is
I mean,
is it a like pay for you? I'm not pay.
No. So when you're sparring is just you have headgear on, and it's boxing, but without judges. So there's no winner or loser. So the more professional guys I work with, you want to get about 60, 70 rounds of sparring in before a fight with somebody who's at that level. So it's very important. And because I have not been able to open a gym here in town yet, I have to take people to other places to spar.
Are you still trying to do that?
Yeah, man, I'm trying to find a spot.
Well, what size do you need?
Something about the size of a garage for about an hour and a half a day.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I can clean out my garage.
Maybe that could be it.
Yeah.
It could be it.
Size of, well.
You know what I mean? It doesn't have to be. I'm only talking about 4 or 5 people on a regular basis generally to start out with.
Yeah. Well, you'd have to put up a ring, though.
Not in the beginning.
You'd have to hang a bag.
The bag. I got bags. I got 2 bags. I got the equipment.
Yeah, and the punt. What do you call the
speed
one?
Bag. Speed bag.
Boy, how they do that, I don't know.
That's easy. It takes about 2 weeks. That's all. But you don't use that much. It's a speed bag that is a lot for just timing. But it's fun. It's like skipping rope with your upper body.
Okay. And then that jump.
I can show you how to do that.
Okay. How about jump roping? That's another thing that amazes me.
And very important for footwork. So if you're want to get into boxing, you want to first you want to stretch out a little bit. Then I'd say three 2-minute rounds of skipping rope, and then you do maybe 4 or 5 rounds of shadow boxing, and then you start to work. Could be the bag, the spar, whatever. But those we start out with loosen up, jump rope, shadow boxing, and shadow boxing is when you're pretending like you're boxing with somebody, you're really working on your technique a lot. But 4 or 5 rounds out, very important.
And do you do the what was coached to you? Like, I want you to do a left followed by a right by an uppercut?
Yeah, I call numbers. I call numbers out a lot.
Like so, what? What are the numbers?
Like 1, 2, 3 would be jab, right hand, left hook. 1, 2, 3. 1, 3, 2 would be jab, left hook, right hand. 4 is an uppercut. Right uppercut, 5 is a left uppercut, 6 is a right hook, and so when they're in their boxing, I'll be yelling 6, and sometimes the other guy will figure out what I'm saying, so I switch numbers.
So so a guy has to be astute when it comes to hearing and interpreting what he had learned.
Yeah, but that comes pretty quick. They get the numbers pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yeah. And that all comes from Customato, Mike Tyson, whom I know, as I think I've mentioned before. Mike was somebody I knew for quite a while. And but Customato, he was the first one to really number punches. And he'd have a mattress with all the numbers on that the kids would hit.
What weight are you going to Faribault tonight? What you're training tonight?
I have 3 guys going with me tonight.
What weights are they?
One's 150. Two of them are about 150. The other's Vicente Alfaro, state champion, professional. So he's just coming with me. I don't know if I'm gonna. He's about 122 pounds, but he's too good for most of these kids to spar with. He just goes easy with them.
If you want to take that sip of coffee, I got a long question, so go ahead and have a sip of coffee.
Ready.
It's 9:30 on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN, a friend you can count on. Gus Marino is my guest this morning.
Gordon Marino, not Gus. Wait a
minute. Oh, you just said Gus D'Amato. So
Gus D'Amato, that's right. Yeah, Gus.
Okay. It comes to us old guys here. So I've always wanted to know this, and help me out and tell the difference, and I'll let you think about it. Not that you need the time, but I do have to take a break. And that is, can we go through the weights from featherweight to heavyweight to even, I think there's one past that, I don't know.
Your vehicle's engine warning light could mean something as simple as a loose gas cap or something serious and potentially expensive if you don't address it right away. Have our professional technicians at Witt Brothers Service diagnose and fix the problem as part of your overall preventative maintenance program. It could save you from costly problems down the road. Stop by Witt Brothers Service at 701 Division Street in downtown Northfield for all of your automotive maintenance and repair needs.
Selfless service is the guiding principle that drives Army National Guard soldiers to be always ready whenever disaster strikes. They are your next-door neighbors and your colleagues in schools, offices, and factories. To be a Guard soldier is to stand ready to serve at all times for family, for community, and for country. To learn more, log on to NationalGuard.com or contact an Army National Guard recruiter in your area. Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association and this station.
Well, thank you, and good morning once again. It is a Monday morning, the 26th of March, 2018. My guest this morning is Professor, Coach, Gus D'Amato. No, we have Gordon Moreno in studio with us right now. We're chit-chatting. He's a very interesting person. I appreciate your being here. Third time. Al Cui, I did about six shows with.
Hmm?
And we never got to
with
him.
Whom?
With Al Cui.
Who's Al Cui?
You're not serious.
I am serious.
How long have you been in Northfield?
20 years.
Oh, okay. Okay, he graduated from Northfield High School.
Uh-huh.
He went to St. Olaf College. He became a congressman in what was then District 1.
Uh-huh, which is where?
Here.
Oh, here? Okay.
Here. He grew up in Denison area. And he became that congressman. And then in 1978, he became governor of Minnesota.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
All right. And I talked to him six times. That's, well,
yeah.
at least 10 hours.
Yeah.
You know, and we never got to him being the governor. We just kept going off on tangents. My favorite story about him is when he and Gretchen got married, their first night was an old farmhouse out in Denison. He says, and all that was in there was a mattress and some blankets. He said, but that was enough. and he's a very religious man.
And that's cute.
He works with prisoners, et cetera. Uh-huh. Heck of a guy. Unfortunately, Gretchen passed away several years ago. Anyhow, I wanted to know everything. I mean, is there, let's start with the professional of age weight classes, the littlest and what
yeah,
it
think,
is to the biggest.
Well, I think you got, I think it's
flyweight,
featherweight, no, flyweight, bantamweight, featherweight, then lightweight, then welterweight, then middleweight, then light heavyweight, then heavy, then cruiserweight, and then heavyweight. But in professional boxing, there's in order to have more championship belts, there's more, there used to be only eight weight classes, now there's 17.
Oh, for God's sake.
I know. So they have they'll have a welterweight, and then super welterweight will be about 3 pounds higher, and then middleweight, and then super middleweight, you know. So, and so you have 17 weight classes, and you have four sanctioning bodies. So often there's only one title that's unified. So you have four sanctioning bodies. So you generally have as many as four world champions in any weight class, which is they call the alphabet soup.
Yeah,
because the sanctioning bodies would be the WBC, WBA, IBF, WBO, you know, that kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. So
World Boxing Association,
right? Right.
So, do you have any interesting stories about an inside look on how things went back in the day, all the way back to let's say Joe Louis? Wasn't he? You're too young to remember Joe Louis.
Are you kidding?
The Brown Bomber.
Are you kidding me? I'm too young to, unfortunately, I never got to see him in action, but he's one of my heroes, you know, because he had to deal with a race issue and he had to deal with the Nazis, for example, when he fought Max Schmeling in 1936, everyone thought that Joe Louis was unbeatable and, I think he was 25-0, and he fought Max Schmeling, who was a German fighter, right?
Yes.
And before that fight, Max Schmeling came in and watched Louis fight, and he, about the sixth round, he goes, I got this guy, and he walks out. But when Schmeling fought Louis, Louis had this habit of throwing a jab and then bringing it back low, which Schmeling could see. And so Schmeling knocked Louis down about six times and knocked him out in 1936. And then Joe went on to win the title. But said, I'm not going to consider myself champion until I beat Schmeling. And so in 1938, June 6th, I think it was, they fought again. So
we're
on the brink of war, right?
Yeah,
on the brink of war.
Where, in America or Germany?
Well, everywhere. The world's 1938.
Yeah, but I mean, where was the fight?
Oh, the fight was in Yankee Stadium, if I recall correctly.
Okay.
So 1938. So, you know, everyone sees war is coming, and whether there's a lot of questions about to what extent Schmeling was really a Nazi. I don't think he was, but he was Hitler's gladiator, you know. And
yeah.
So Hitler listened to the fight, but Lewis over the radio with Schmeling's wife right there. So a lot of but you had all this pressure about the war. I mean, Roosevelt called up Lewis, said you got to win, you know, Joe. And then Joe Lewis was the first African American champion since Jack Johnson, so about 30 years, and he had to be because Jack Johnson was such a wild man, and people didn't want another African American champion. He got in all kinds of trouble, and I was very outspoken. And Joe had to keep his mouth shut about a lot of stuff, and so when he fought, so I always say it's the most incredible event of the 20th century in sports. He'd been knocked out by Schmeling before, which is really hard to come back from a knockout because it feels like somebody has you hypnotized in your number. Especially, he wasn't just knocked out, like, he was knocked down like six times. And, so Joe had that stress on him. Then he had the racial issue. I mean, there were a lot of whites who were rooting for Schmeling. Jimmy Carter tells a story, that, at his plantation in Georgia, his father let the workers there listen to the fight on the porch. But and when Joe won the fight, the workers walked away and were cheering, but they had to wait till they got away from the farm because Jimmy said his father was rooting for Schmeling, you know.
Gee.
You know, so that was very common. So Joe had the race issue on him and the Nazi issue, and he knocked him out in one round, and I think it was one of the most unbelievable and most important, and there's all kinds of songs about him, and he was amazing. He held the title for 12 years, 25 defenses of the title, and he was a lot of the reason he stood up for Jackie Robinson a lot of the time. When Jackie Robinson was in the army and got in trouble, and Jackie said if it wasn't for Joe Lewis, there would have been no Jackie Robinson. So, but he ended up a mess, you know. He was
The last I remember of him, there's terminology in your boxing world that's punch drunk, and we all know what that is now because of the NFL and their concussions.
Right.
And he ended up being a host for one of the casinos.
Yeah, greeter or something, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Frank Sinatra got him a job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, I saw him just recollection that on an interview or some sort, but you could tell he wasn't.
Yeah.
Fully engaged in what was going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's got to be a sad sight.
Oh, not only that, but he was ripped off all his money. So he did all these boxing shows for the USO during the war. I mean, he joined the army and donated his purses all the time, and then he was taxed for them. And so he was in all this trouble with the IRS, and they just haunted him. It was just terrible. He's a real American hero, though. I mean, he's an amazing, amazing man.
Well, that's the one that I remember. I'm going to just go through some I remember.
Yeah.
And you kind of tell me about them. Once again, Dr. Moreno is my guest here at KYMN. And he is a professional when it comes to boxing and knowledge, and also a philosophy professor at St. Olaf College. They're on spring break right now. I asked you earlier before we went on the air, aren't you going to go to Fort Lauderdale?
Nope, philosophy conference.
Can you imagine that when you were in...
Yeah.
They do it in high school now.
Yeah.
High school kids go to Mexico and Florida.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Panama City's another big one. They go to Panama City a lot now.
Wow. I missed out on that.
Was Fort Lauderdale... What did they do when you were in high school? Was it Fort Lauderdale? Was that the big place?
No. The spring break, you went to Mass. It was Lent and all that stuff. There was no going anywhere. It was just time off.
Yeah, but then there was those movies Where the Boys Are and all those stuff with Frankie.
Connie Francis, yeah.
Frankie Avalon or something like that.
Well, that was in the movies.
Yeah,
On the east side of St. Paul.
You didn't do that.
Yeah. No. Yet some good fighters come from the
sure
east side
did.
Of St. Paul.
Yeah.
Okay, another boxer that I'm sure you got a library of knowledge. Does that mean the same thing? Library of knowledge?
Thanks. It's good.
Okay. A library of stories.
Yeah.
Rocky Marciano.
Oh, man. I'm Italian, so don't be talking about Rock. The Rock. Love him. Love him, man.
Now, he was a heavyweight?
Yeah, heavyweight champion. 49-0, only 188 pounds. And It said the power of his punch could lift the front of a car in the test of the U.S. government testing service. His right hand was, and he trained like a monster, man. He was something. And one of my mentors was Angelo Dundee, who was Ali's trainer. And Angelo was telling me one day that when Rocky came to town, he was from Brockton, Massachusetts, and came into New York with his friend Al Silvani. And, you know, I want to be a pro fighter. He was pretty old by then, too, because he'd been through the Army. He'd only had a few amateur bouts, and he was so clumsy that Ange said they took him down to the – they didn't want him to train in a regular gym because he thought he'd get laughed at and everything. But he was so – because he was so clumsy. And so they took him to the CYO, and they said, man, the guy's clumsy, but, man, can he punch? He could.
CYO.
Catholic Youth Organization,
hey,
Jim.
I went to CYC.
Did you?
Yeah. Up downtown St. Paul. Yeah. That's where I did my first boxing.
Yeah.
And you know what I found out?
What?
I was scared.
Yeah, sure.
And I thought, this guy's bigger than me, and I don't know, but I'm going there. And he hit me, and it didn't hurt.
Because you had so much adrenaline, you're probably so excited.
Yeah. Right? And I thought, oh, well, gee, I can do this. And so it was pretty fun.
Well, that's one of the lessons you get from boxing, I think, that so it crosses over into life, is not to be afraid of your anxiety, that it's natural to be anxious. And instead of, you don't want to panic about the anxiety, you want to react to it with, okay, it's reasonable to be anxious. I'm about to box. Just sit with the anxiety and not freak out about it. So it puts you into a new relationship with your fears and your anger and all kinds of things like that.
And that's where your background in philosophy comes in handy when training, I would assume.
Yeah, 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 I think so. Yeah.
I'm going to take another break, and we'll be right back. We're having fun here, at least I am. I hope you are.
I am, too.
A doctor, professor. Do you know Bob Will?
No.
Professor Emeritus of the Economic Department at Carleton College.
No, I don't know.
He just turned 90.
Did he?
And he's a sweetheart.
Yeah.
And I call him the good doctor, professor. And we come from different sides when it comes to politics, but we always...
Like, you and I probably do, too.
are you conservative?
No.
We'll be right back.
The Army National Guard is committed to keeping the country safe and our communities secure. Composed of hundreds of thousands of citizen soldiers from all walks of life, the Guard is always ready to respond to local or national emergencies. We protect the homeland. We're always there when called upon, and in every state and territory, we stand guard for our communities. To learn more, log on to NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Minnesota Army National Guard. Aired by the Minnesota Broadcasters Association at this station.
Residential or commercial, Cannon Valley Water in Dundas is the place to call for water. Whether it's a complete water conditioning system or just salt delivery and filters, Cannon Valley Water can take care of it. And Cannon Valley Water can also deliver Candy Yohai premium water right to your house or business at great rates, too. Chippewa Springs is as pure today as it was when we first tested it over a century ago, and is proudly distributed by Cannon Valley Water. Pickups are now located at 609 Stafford Lane in Dundas, just behind Aldi.
Sure.
Call Cannon Valley for your water today.
You can hear me okay, right?
Yep, I can
hear you. He doesn't like to wear the earphones, and I like my guests to wear them. Usually I have bumper music from the year you got out of high school.
Yeah, you did that before. You threw me with some of the, yeah, gave me a little quiz. That was cool.
Yeah.
What happened to that music?
Oh, I'll get it during the break at 10 o'clock. Because I like to do that.
Yeah, it
brings
fun.
Back good memories.
Yeah.
Once again, if you just tuned in, thank you. You're listening to the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio, a friend you can count on. And my guest this morning is Professor Gordon Marino, and he is also a coach for boxing. And we're talking about former boxers. I think one of my favorite boxers of all time would be Sugar Ray Leonard.
Sugar Ray Leonard or Sugar Ray Robinson?
Well, Sugar Ray Robinson was when I was a kid,
Sugar Ray Leonard.
Was very good. But the
Sugar Leonard, Ray Robinson was better than Sugar Ray Leonard.
Well, they Sugar were Ray different Robin- weight classes, though, weren't they?
Well, no, not really. No, but Sugar Ray Robinson won championships at lightweight, welterweight, and middleweight, and he almost won the light heavyweight title, but he collapsed from exhaustion, heat exhaustion, 14th round, I think it was, against Joey Maxim. But he was the greatest fighter ever.
Oh.
Sugar Ray Leonard's up there, too, though.
Well, I thought so.
Yeah.
Is he the one that did Duran or whatever his name is?
Yeah, he beat Duran. He beat Hearns. He beat, he's a great one.
Well, tell me.
I've been to his house. I was at his house once.
Duran or?
No, Leonard.
Well, isn't he a nice guy?
Yeah, he's a nice guy. Very, very smart.
Yeah, that's.
And one of the things that was amazing about him is he's one of the few boxers that was able to keep their money and very intelligent person. Yeah, and very perceptive. And I got thrown out of his house, though, because whenever I interview boxers, I always end the interview with, okay, you know, give me something I can teach to my kids. And they usually get very passionate about that. They show you some moves, and his wife said, get him out of here, because we go from one to the other.
Yeah.
His wife said, get him out of here. He'll be here all day.
Where was this?
Out in Santa Monica.
Was it in a big palatial place?
Oh, yeah. An unbelievable place. Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
You know, that's why I drank 7-Up.
Why?
Why?
Yeah. Because of the Leonard commercial?
Yeah, he was a spokesperson for 7-Up.
That's right, yeah.
You know, you had your Pepsi, you had your Coke.
Yeah, that's right,
Dr.
I forgot
Pepper,
that.
But he did 7-Up.
Yeah, yeah.
And isn't it crazy? Now, that advertising worked on me.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, I'm trying to think of some other boxes. Did you watch that TV special where they met Duran they met in both Mexico.
Yeah, the question was why did Duran quit in the second fight?
Yeah, no mas.
No mas, which was very unusual. Duran was a real killer. You know, he was really, and one of the things about Duran is he wouldn't. In boxing, it's really important piece of etiquette is that after the fight you go over and shake hands, and Duran would never do that. Neither would Marvin Hagler. He just wanted to maintain a certain image and. He was one time he had somebody in a coma and he said, well, next time I'll kill him.
Oh.
So Duran was Joe Frazier used to say, Duran looks like Charles Manson, and he did.
Oh,
you know,
boy.
And but
Smokin' Joe.
Smokin' Joe, my favorite of all time.
He was a very, very nice person.
Very nice person.
Tell me about your interpretation of Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier in their fights.
Well, those fights were just the first fight was amazing. I mean, the whole world, it was, you know, not quite at the level of Lewis versus Schmeling, but almost. And everybody in the world was either Joe Frazier or Ali. You know, and Ali had not lost; he'd been laid off for 3.5 years, and. So the hoopla around the fight was just amazing, and what a battle, you know. And first few rounds, Ali was taunting Joe, and he thought it was going to be an easy fight, and then Joe got his rhythm and took care of business, and it was amazing, you know. And knocked Ali down in the 15th round and broke his jaw. I think his jaw was all swollen, but Joe went to the hospital and almost died after the fight. He pushed himself so hard, he was in the hospital for a week, and. I remember Ali said, because he couldn't get his blood pressure down, and Ali said, if he dies, I'm going to quit boxing, you know. And then they fought again. Then Joe got knocked out by George Foreman. 6 times he was knocked down in Jamaica, right?
That's when, you didn't like that?
I love Joe. Joe's my hero, man.
I mean, that George Foreman.
I love George Foreman, but yeah. Now I do, but I was mad at him then, Joe. Yeah. Joe got up 6 times against Foreman, and Foreman had the strength of Superman. I mean, he was unbelievably just pure power. Just you know.
How about Michael Spinks?
And he's a great light heavyweight, but you saw what happened to him against Mike Tyson. 90 seconds, and he destroyed Larry Holmes as Larry Holmes was about to break Rocky Marciano's record, and Spinks beat him and won the unanimous decision, won the heavyweight title, and. Poor Larry Holmes, who's one of the most underrated fighters in history, you know, lost the title and the chance to beat Marciano's record. So,
how about Holyfield?
He's a great fighter. Yeah, yeah, great, really tremendous heart.
Well, you didn't say there was such conviction.
I feel he might have been on human growth hormones a lot of the time. I'm
a
little bit, you know, I'm not sure about that, but he's an amazing person.
Was that commonplace in your, as far as your knowledge is concerned, that boxers did dope up?
Some of them, I don't know. I've just heard that, and so it's always because he went from being a light heavyweight to cruiserweight to heavyweight, I shouldn't say that. I feel bad that I said that, but yeah, he's a very, very good person, and very, very tough. I mean, he's just unafraid of, not afraid of anyone, and not a big guy, not a really big guy, and always stayed in shape. And
yeah, how about we already talked about Rocky Marciano?
Yeah.
What about the other Rocky?
I don't. Stallone.
Stallone, yeah.
I don't like
him. No, what about the film though?
The first one was good. The first one was good. The rest of them, come on.
When I see a movie where there is a disc jockey or a newsman or whatever,
yeah,
and they're showing that individual at work, I look at the equipment that they're using, and I can see, for example, that the microphone isn't on because the needles aren't bouncing, and you know the you can just see little things that you know are just set up. And I'm wondering, when you watch those films, Rocky, you liked the first one, you said. The rest were just paydays. Did they look pretty authentic to you?
No, the choreography was terrible.
Okay, that's what I want to
hear. It was absolutely terrible. Nobody fights like that, you know. But and he was had a bunch of lawsuits because Chuck Wepner said that was a story that was on him, and he never, Chuck Wepner, who was a boxer, who fought Ali and knocked him down and then was knocked out in the 15th round. He's the Bayonne Bleeder, big guy from New Jersey. There's been a couple specials on him, but the story it was supposed to be about, I think it was a Chuck Wepner story, and he never got paid for it, you know, so there's some lawsuits about that.
Now, that name Chuck Wepner, that just comes into my mind. Does anybody care about flyweights or welterweights? Or
yeah, but not so much in the United States.
Lightweights?
Yeah, but it depends what country you're in.
Oh, I suppose Thailand,
yeah,
Mexico.
Yeah, sure. So the boxing market's different in different places. I thought we were going to talk some philosophy here. I thought you were in philosophy class. You're going to ask me some questions about philosophy. You're like one of my students. They come in and they come in. They'll start asking me questions about boxing, and they might be flunking the philosophy class.
Well, here's the deal. All right. You're a great conversationalist. Your subject in boxing, I can kind of go along with and enjoy hearing your stories because you have first-person relationships with them. And there's many things to ask about, concussions and the weight of the gloves and what do you think about the caged fighting and all that. In philosophy, I'm pretty limited on what I can ask, but I will try to do more philosophy.
I'm just jabbing you. I'm just boxing with you.
And I took it, didn't
I? And you countered.
And I countered. Okay, I like this. So back to philosophy. And now we're freshmen. Remember that. We don't know anything. Now, you indicated that it's a lot of short readings with repetitive reading to get what the philosopher is trying to get across. So how short is short?
Oh, so if you were in my class, Wayne, we'd probably have about, over a break, I might assign 20 pages. And we might be reading Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil right now in one of my classes, so it'd be 20 pages. But very, very complex readings, you know. That you need to interpret. So a lot of the work is just the interpretation. In that sense, it's like biblical interpretation.
Can you be right and wrong?
I think there's a spectrum of, same with the Bible, there'd be a spectrum of interpretations that would be in the ballpark, and then some would be outside that spectrum, right?
So after I read the 20 pages 20 times, how am I going to be tested by a professor of philosophy to get a grade that is equal to the effort?
Well, I would tell you to stop worrying, stop thinking in terms of grades. That's like on your hard drive, this evaluation thing. You're supposed to get into the text, live dangerously, and not worry about the grade. Worry about whether or not you understand the text, and part of that is being able to ask questions about it. So, as I was saying before, so for students who have a hard time speaking up, sometimes you just say, could you clarify this sentence, Doc? I don't understand what it means. That's all, you know. And then later on, then you may get to the point where you get more comfortable and you could comment on a passage. Right?
I had a professor that taught Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems to me that these run parallel.
Oh, yeah. Where did you go to college, Mark?
Brown.
Huh?
Brown.
Brown. Okay.
You know where Brown's located, don't you?
What?
You know where Brown is located?
Rhode Island.
Okay.
Yeah.
Steve Jordan went there, tight end for the Vikings.
Oh, yeah. Rhode, beautiful state, too.
You Mine was on Lake Street.
Was it?
Brown Institute.
Brown Institute, yeah.
When I first came to town, I wanted to get to know people.
So you stay with the Brown?
And everybody asked where you go to school. Yeah. Well, I'd say Harding.
Right.
St.
Right.
Paul's East Side.
Right.
And it was like, no, you know, college. So I quickly learned when they finally, I'm sitting there, I'll never forget it. I was at the, what they called the golf club.
Yeah.
And conversation got around, you're new in town, all that. Well, where did you go to school? I said, I went to Brown. Oh.
Yeah,
just
right.
Let it lay. Then I walk away because I don't want to, you know, show that I really didn't. 4 minutes before 10 o'clock on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio. So anyhow, I read this 20 pages, and I read it 20 times, and now I have to write an essay telling you, not telling you, I write an essay on my interpretation and the meaning of that piece or those 20 pages, and then there is no grade.
No, so not in your first year class to be just a midterm, a final, and a short paper. And the short paper would be pretty straightforward, exegetical. So I might ask you to write on some passage in Plato's Apology or something like that. But I'm also teaching a senior seminar, and there they write a short paper and a long paper, so there's no exam. So they're writing a short paper this week, and it's on Nietzsche. So
on
Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, who was an existentialist and German philosopher of great renown.
From when to when?
Late 1800s, no. Because of high school, there's a tendency for them to come in and go, what do you want? Give me the guidelines. You know, I said, stop being babies. I want a good essay. You know, so, but sometimes in high school, they think there's a formula for good writing or, you know, for everything. And so I have to discourage that and to get them out of this mindset of, you know, what do you want? What do you want? That's not how to approach writing. So that's an issue. But one of the big things is to come up with, and I think this is true in life, is to come up with good questions. I mean, you know that as an interviewer, as our interviewer, that it's coming up with good questions that's really important. And so that's what I try to say. Let's not get going with the paper until we have a real question, not one that you think you've answered already.
It brings to mind, I was just thinking the other day, how's that? I was thinking. And you can tell when an interview is almost set up in the direction of the person that's being interviewed.
Right.
And the interviewer would say, ask a question, and the interviewee would say, that's a great question.
And is that usually when it's set up?
Sometimes.
Right.
Sometimes. Because they've been through it. They've talked to various people that interviewed them. And ego is very important to people in my business. Is it in yours?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when I hear somebody say to me, Wayne, that was a good question, I really believe them when they, my guess.
Oh, because you haven't set it up.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wayne, we had the Stormy Daniels interview last night. Do most of these people on these interviews get the questions beforehand? Do you think?
I think they're coached. And I understand it because I like 60 Minutes is 50 years old this year.
Yeah, I know.
KYMN Radio is 50 years old this
right.
year. Now, if you want to equate the two, you're more than welcome to do so.
Yeah.
But Mike, I think that the style that 60 Minutes had more in the past was more, it was gotcha. There was a lot of gotcha type interviews, which I think people enjoy. But I think that this woman is well-versed in what she's going to say. She's taken her attorney's advice and whatever she says. And I quite frankly thought that the guy that did the interview, Cooper?
Anderson Cooper.
Anderson Cooper.
Scott Ledoux.
Yeah. Anyhow, I know, I believe that he's very liberal.
Yeah.
And so therefore I anticipated that he was going to just feed questions to her that would be real negative. And I think from the little bit that I watched, I didn't watch the whole thing. And I thought he was being pretty much fair, you know.
Yeah,
in his question.
But no. But in general, do you think that they're getting the questions first? I mean, forget that Stormy Daniels.
I think, well, yeah,
like
I think
CNN and all these.
Oh, well, you know, CNN. They did that during the presidential debates. They had their questions set up.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
the interviewer. Here's what I'm going to ask you. Prepare, but I'm not going to tell him.
Oh, so, you're getting. Oh man, I see where you're going with Donna yeah. Brazile. That stuff. Oh no, here we go. Okay.
I suppose you're a Pelosi fan.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a Pelosi fan, no, no. But I'm not a Trump fan.
Okay. And there are a lot of people that aren't. And in this community, in Northfield, Minnesota, I try to not get deeply into politics and political beliefs. I have admitted I am conservative, but I don't like to diss people, except with Bob Will. We kind of had fun back and forth, but... This audience right now probably agrees with your way of thinking more so than mine.
I don't know, Bob. Just as I told you, I draw a distinction between Trump and conservatism. I don't think Trump is conservative because I find him disrespectful and not abiding by norms. Yeah. So I don't think he's like John McCain or someone like that. So my trouble with Trump is
John McCain is a war hero.
Yeah,
and I respect him.
Remember when the woman came up and. When during the debates, and said that Obama was a terrorist or something like that, and John McCain had the grace to say, no, he's a good man, a good family man, a good American. He's a respectful person.
Do you want to hear more about the interview?
Yeah.
Last night? Okay, we'll go to the news.
Okay.
All right. This is your radio station. This is KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, 1080 on your AM dial for almost 50 years now, and 95.1 FM. The One. My guest this morning is Gordon Moreno. We'll be back with more right after this important news message.
Russians out, markets up. I'm John Trout. The U.S. is kicking out 60 Russian diplomats and ordering Russia's consulate in Seattle to close in response to the poisoning of an ex-spy in Britain, correspondent Michelle Kaczynski.
The administration isn't just calling these diplomatic staff. They're calling them intelligence agents. In fact, at one point, they called them aggressive gatherers of intelligence, that this will significantly diminish the ability of Russia to spy on the U.S.
Poland, Germany, and Lithuania will expel Russian diplomats there, too. International trade issues are giving investors uncertainty on Wall Street in early trading.
After the more than 1,100-point loss at the end of last week, confidence is hard to find on Wall Street. Investors will keep a close eye on how foreign markets close. While China announced a modest retaliatory action in the wake of President Trump's tariffs, investors fear more are coming.
There's Steve Kastenbaum. The Dow is up 487 points, or 2%. The S&P and NASDAQ are higher. The final four of the NCAA men's basketball tournament are set. Saturday's games in San Antonio will feature Villanova against Kansas and Michigan facing underdog Loyola of Chicago, the Ramblers.
And in attendance will be team chaplain, 98-year-old Sister Jean.
I keep saying, you know, be careful, San Antonio. The Ramblers are on their way.
The Nun has gained millions of fans during the tournament, and there are even plans for Sister Jean bobbleheads. But she and the Loyola faithful have their eyes set on a championship. I'm Clayton Neville.
Lawyers for the widow of the shooter in the Pulse nightclub massacre say prosecutors failed to disclose the shooter's father was a confidential FBI informant. A merger deal in the food industry is on the table. The Campbell Soup Company is set to purchase Lance Snack Products and Snyder's of Hanover pretzels today. I'm John Trout.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine, birthday greetings, bottle of wine? If I've been out till 2:45,
we're back on the Wayne Eddy Affair on KYMN Radio on this Monday morning, kind of dreary right now. We had a little bit of snow earlier this morning, but a lot less than was anticipated last week when they were saying we were going to have 2 to 4 inches of snow. Glad that didn't happen. I have to make a reminder here for everyone. As you know, everyone has a story. Well, not every story, however, is told. Family stories, sometimes, well, they're handed down through generations, and sometimes they're buried with those who lived them. Today's story is about a woman learning a horrifying family truth and a plea to tell the world. Today's 15 with the author is different. Terry Knight's guest is Lauren Haupt. She's not an author, but her grandfather told her the story of his time in Dachau. Wow. As a political prisoner in Nazi Germany. He wanted her to tell the world. The book titled The Red Badge is not complete. Today's 15 with the author is about the process and an encouragement for those who have a story to tell it. That's at 11 o'clock this morning on 15 with the author and Terry Knight. Well, speaking about an author, I have an author seated across from me, and that would be Professor Dr. Gordon Marino and boxing coach. Gordon, just lean into that mic or pull it towards you.
Sorry, Mark.
Yeah, get comfortable. You got a book coming out. Let's talk about that again.
Yeah, it's called The Existentialist Survival Guide, How to Live Authentically in an Inauthentic Age, and it'll be coming out from HarperCollins on April 24th, and I'll have a reading it May 17th at the Content Bookstore in Northfield.
You want me to do the reading?
That's funny, they're doing an audio book, and I guess I mumble a little bit, and they said that I won't be doing the reading.
I mean, you're going to be doing the reading at
Content. Here, yeah. I have a tendency to mumble and speak 100 miles an hour. Yeah. Because I'm from the Jersey Shore.
Yeah, the Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore.
I learned through a professor from St. Olaf a while ago the ins and outs of that profession that most people don't know about.
Right.
And that is, you must be published. The money's involved with publishing and all that can be distorted and confusing and not fair, etc., and all that. So is this particular book that you have written, is that something that is you from Northfield, Minnesota, or is that a book from St. Olaf College?
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Because, so you have a lot of, in the academic world, you want to publish in academic journals and academic presses, but those aren't for the wider audiences. This book is for a wide audience. That's why it's HarperCollins instead of one of the university presses. So there are two different tracks there, and sometimes people in academia will look down upon writing if you write for a wider audience. You know, it's not elitist enough or something. But I believe that if you have something to say in a non-technical field, you ought to be able to say it to people that are educated outside the academy, and if you can't, that says something about your work. So I try to write for a wider audience.
Well, this rookie over here, the thought that went through my head when you were talking there was that publish for publishing's sake and income.
Hmm.
Yeah, writing because you have to. Well, I think I'll write something today so I can get that raise or get tenure or whatever.
Yeah. So you have to publish in order to get tenure, that kind of thing. So, but when you publish in academic circles, it's for a very small readership. For example, say when I'm writing on Kierkegaard for the academic world, it's only a few hundred people that might be involved. Whereas books of the kind, the one I just wrote, is for a wider audience. And so
when you write for your tenure, etc., is that a book or is it a magazine article? Institutional?
Yeah. So yes. So you want to get in these referee journals. So one of the ways you score points for tenure is to have articles published in referee journals, blind referee journals.
A referee?
So refereed means you submit the article and no one knows or is not supposed to know who the author is, and there'll be three people reading it and they'll decide whether or not it's publishable.
Okay.
Right. And different journals have different levels of prestige. So that's how that's kind of the ball game in academia.
Is it politics?
No, I don't.
Some?
There's always some. It's hard to imagine a field that doesn't involve any politics, but That's the idea of blind referees is to keep the politics out of it,
mm-hmm.
right? So you don't know who's writing the article. Not supposed to know who's writing the article, and so that's how you score some points for the tenure process.
Now, the book that you're publishing is by yourself through this company. Will it ultimately? Is it a goal to have it be considered a textbook?
No, I have a few textbooks out there right now with Random House, but no, the goal of this is to reach a wide audience. It'll be reviewed in the Wall Street Journal and maybe the New York Times. And I have another career as a journalist. I've been writing for newspapers and for quite some time. It's just kind of independent of what I do in academia.
Will it go over the head of most people?
No, I don't think so. No, that was my intention to present something that wasn't watered down, but yet was accessible. So on topics like anxiety, depression, death, love, things like that. And again, it's filled with a lot of personal stories, some of them very raw.
Actually, people you've interviewed?
No, my own life.
Your own life? Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, tell me one. Tell me a raw one.
Let me see. Let me. Some of them are extremely raw. Some of the things that happened to my father. My father had some drinking problems and what it was like growing up with that.
So did mine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so one of the stories is in this chapter on love, I use a story from Dostoevsky to explain that one of the biggest tests in love is to accept love, to accept being loved for who you are, right? Not who you want to be. Like a lot of us want to be loved for, you know, and want to be loved as an admired, right? And I have a friend who's had a very in another country who had a very difficult marriage and actually had a lot of affairs and another family, in fact, that his wife didn't know about for a long time, and then his wife got cancer and she died, and she did know, she did come to find out about things. But when I asked him how he felt about his wife dying, and he said she loved me for who I was. She loved me and she knew me, right? She knew all his foibles, right? And so one of the claims I'm trying to make in there is that part of the task of love is to be able to accept love from people who really know us for who we are.
So did he go in deep depression to have her have that attitude towards him?
No, he was with her towards the end, but I just thought it was very poignant that he didn't say she knew me and she still loved me. He said she knew me and she loved me, you know? And Dostoevsky says part of some of the reason people can't accept, say, Jesus is because Jesus can't, because there's a lot of power tripping in love. You only want to be loved for who you want to be, not for in your entirety, right? And so we don't want to be loved by people, and so we can't accept being loved.
Well, one of the things that make life acceptable through its trials and tribulations is to have that partner
mm-hmm.
that you love, not in love. The in love may have ended a while back.
Right.
But that you truly love for who they are. And part of that love is because they accept you for who you are.
Exactly, yeah.
And when you can have that stability, even with minor arguments, you know you have each other's back. That can happen in the military. It can happen
That's
on
true.
A football team. You know, you got to have that trust and confidence and know that you're loved as much as you love them.
Yeah, that's right. But I also...
That wasn't a great statement?
Yeah, I think it was. No, I think you're right, Wayne. But writing this chapter on love really helped me to appreciate what a blessing it is, the intimacy, to be able to share your life with someone day in and day out. And I just think of it's just an amazing blessing.
No secrets.
No secrets.
No paranoia.
No, yeah.
No guilt.
No, there's guilt. I mean, things can be...
Well, like you didn't do the dishes.
Yeah. But just how, what a blessing intimacy is, and then how hard it is when you lose someone. You know, it's like a continent falling off. You know, to share your life, to have your life entangled with someone for 50, 60 years, and then suddenly the bed is empty. You know,
I read of a story where a woman had a dog.
Mm-hmm.
That she loved, and it was presented to her after she had had a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
And she had no children in her life. But that dog was lost. And she went looking for it. She spent her entire days, months, years looking for this dog. And she finally found the dog, snatched it from the owners, and would not give it back up. Until the veterinarians came along with that thing that they...
A chip
in their ear, wherever they put it. And it learned that that dog was not hers. And she cried like a baby. And I thought, it's just a dog.
Oh, no way.
But to her, that was everything.
Wow.
That's overly love, don't you think?
I don't think so. No, the relationship with our pets, and like I feel like I remember there's times that I want I've had dogs all my life, and but two or three of them, man, they're just unconditional love, and I sometimes have felt like I wish I could tell them how grateful I am to them. Like there was one dog I had to put down a few years ago that I was so close to, and it just about killed me. I could almost start crying about it right now, and I wanted her to know how much I loved her and how much I appreciated her. You know what I mean? That kind of, and they again, they know us and love us, you know. And that again, we talk about trust, and
we're Howard's places now. There used to be a place there called it was a mobile gas station. A guy by the name of Toad Ryan ran that. This is 40 years ago or more, and he had a black lab, and there was a doctor. A veterinarian that lived on the southeast side at that time. Now, southeast side is miles. But the dog had to be put down. And he didn't have the heart to do it, so he asked me to do it.
To put the dog down?
Oh, asked me to bring it to the vet. And I figured the guy just couldn't do it. He couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So he said, just someday. He was a real friendly dog, and he was old. So I put him in the car, and I brought him up to Dr. Fred, whatever his last name was, and had him put the dog down. Now, I was not attached to the dog other than it was at the gas station all the time, and I petted it. But I felt real bad. But I did have a cat that I had to put down after 19 years.
Yeah.
That one, you don't have that relationship.
That's a whole big chunk of your life, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, 19 years, it's my buddy.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons I didn't want a dog is because of all the work involved, and it's worth it, the love that you get back. But how long do they last? 7 years? 10 years?
Yeah, at most.
You know it's going to be a heartbreak eventually.
Yep.
So getting back to Jesus, that's what I wonder. I had a guy on from Carleton College that ran the, where they look at the stars, astronomy or whatever it is.
Observatory.
And I asked him, I said, do you believe in God? And he said, yes. And I thought, well, how can you when you know all about the stars and the Big Bang Theory and all that? Yeah. So what in philosophy professors' mind and heart does religion have to do with reality?
Oh, that differs from philosophy professor to philosophy professor. But so the philosopher I work on, Soren Kierkegaard, his whole life was a meditation on what it means to have faith, and he said that faith is this collision with reason. You're never going to get to faith from reason, and I think he's right about that. So he's the one who's famous for the phrase the leap of faith, right? That faith is a leap over a broad, ugly ditch, you would say, that you don't get there from reason, and that involves this collision with the understanding.
Well, that's well put. When I have discussion on religion, and whether it's Christianity or whatever, it always ends up on faith. It always ends up on faith. That Michael, whatever his last name was, guy that sang the song Faith, You Gotta Have Faith. To me, it all really boils right down to that. You gotta have faith in your beliefs.
Right, but the question is, what is faith?
Or belief in your faith.
So, but philosophers of religion ask the question of what is faith? What does it mean to have faith? You know, what's it involve?
What role does sex have in regards to philosophy? I mean, are there great philosophers that had different ideas about human relationships, commitments, faith to each other, monogamous, or...
Yeah, the meaning of sexuality has changed over millennia. The different cultures have different views on sexuality. So, yeah, they're very different. But could you be more specific, my friend?
Yeah. Well, if let's say that a young boy and girl, let's make it 18.
Okay.
And they're having sexual relations. Could they go back in history, studying philosophy, and then show to the priest or the minister or the mom or the dad, well, look at what Aristotle said about this?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the Greeks would have said there's nothing wrong with it, right? Yeah. So the question relationship between sex and morality is one. You know, why is the Virgin Mary given such moral high ground because she didn't have sex? So the significance of sexuality is a very interesting question. You know, why we put so much weight on it, and not everyone does, right? This has come up in politics quite a bit, right? Who cares whether Clinton or Trump had affairs, right? The sexuality is a private thing, and there's more important. It's not necessarily.
Do you believe that?
No, I'm not stating any opinions on that right now. I'm just saying some people would say it's not indicative of someone's character that too much we place too much emphasis on a relationship between sexuality and morality, right?
Well,
some people say that. So yeah, that would be a philosophical position.
And some people feel that what you just said, it has no bearing on whether we're going to nuke Korea, but
they would even say it has no bearing on whether or not you're a good person, a kind person, right?
Right.
I mean,
there's
different indices of.
And the reason I ask that question is I don't know. I don't know if the philosophy has a discipline that zeroes in on different aspects of life.
Yeah, so we could talk
obviously
about that.
It does.
So we could raise a question like, you know, what does a person's sexual behavior tell you about their character? That's it. That's a fair question. What do you think?
What do I think?
Yeah.
Well, I think that immorality is bad. I think it doesn't. It isn't the whole makeup of the man or woman, and they're probably redeeming factors in other areas of one's life.
Right. But I would think that where it would come into play is if you made certain vows, took certain marital vows and broke them, so that wouldn't just involve sex. Sex would be breaking promises. Now, you take someone like Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, who were two existential philosophers, Sartre was probably the most famous philosopher in the world for many years and died in 1980, and they had an open relationship, but very open about it. So, you know, they had sex with other people, but they were a pair, but they weren't married. They didn't believe in marriage. So
Man and woman?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. As opposed to someone who took marital vows and so in the breaking the vows would involve more than, it's not just the sex, it's the breaking of a promise, right?
And that has something to do with
that would seem
morality, which has something to do with philosophy.
Which seems to say something about the character, right?
Okay.
Not the fact that they had sex, but the fact that they either lied about it or broke a promise. Okay.
So what about a prostitute?
So there is a good deal of... There's some discussion about that. I read an article recently in which a woman was arguing that if... someone who goes out and looks for a sugar daddy or whatever is, you know, looks to just to marry a rich man. That's her, her business, and she should be allowed to do that. And that on a, there's the government or morality has no right to, has no justification for saying that if a person wants to exchange their sexual charms for money, and this person would say only on a kind of private basis, not on a, you know, a brothel or something like that, right? That's her choice, you know. She was arguing for, yeah, saying that on a private basis, it should be, it's not something that, it's persons using their charms to gain power and wealth.
So, as we continue our conversation here, I'm going to take a really brief break, and I got a question, and mm-hmm. it's about philosophy.
Sure.
Okay. We'll be right back with our guest here this morning on KYMN Radio. Gordon Marino is my guest, professor and boxing coach.
Wenzel Heating and Air Conditioning in Eagan is a customer-focused company that employs highly trained people whose goal is to be the best service company in the 13-county metro area. When you deal with Wenzel HVAC, you can expect a positive working environment, practical advice and suggestions, flexible payment options, cutting-edge technology, headache-free maintenance, a dedication to service, and technical excellence. Serving the South Metro, Wenzel HVAC in Eagan. Call 651-894-9898.
This is in Motown, but it's from 1972.
Wait a little while from now, I'm not feeling any less sound. I promised myself to treat myself and visit a nearby town. I'm climbing to the top.
Sound familiar?
Yeah, bro. This guy's going to commit suicide. What's his name?
His name is Gilbert O'Sullivan.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. That was a big hit.
Yeah, it's called Alone Again.
Alone Again Naturally.
Yeah.
Alone Again Naturally.
And we're doing philosophy here, yeah. So you're in-depth thinking generally.
And he's going to commit suicide in this song, isn't he?
I don't remember.
I think so, I'm climbing to a tower or something.
I don't know. You want to Google it while we're talking?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know. Jeff Johnson would probably know, or Terry Knight.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's funny.
1972, I was busy.
It's funny because he had also had a lot of, before, and they say in the 60s, these songs about car crashes. People die in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right?
Bye-bye, American Pie is one. Crossing the railroad tracks, that fateful night.
Yeah, stuff like that, right?
Just a bunch of this. On the railroad track, yeah. So, here's what I'm thinking. Once again, folks, my guest this morning is Professor Marino. He's a boxing coach, a philosopher professor at St. Olaf College, has his doctorate degree. Gordon, here's the question. In your business of philosophy, it seems to me that it can be one of two things, very enlightening or very depressing.
Okay. Why do you think it could be depressing? What strikes you as depressing about it?
Well, you're into deep thought.
Okay. Thinking about the foundations of things, say, like the question we just brought up, is there really a connection between sexuality and morality? Okay, so why would that be depressing, though?
Well, because you may not, you may conflict yourself.
Okay, so that it could be depressing in the sense that you might discover that you really don't have clear answers to certain questions. Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, it could confuse someone. Yeah, that's true. And some people throw it off because of that.
So who do you go to?
What do you mean, who do you go to?
Well, if you're arguing with yourself and something that's moral or immoral, is that what the role of Catholic priest was in the years of confession? Is that what the role of a clinical psychologist is, or a psychiatrist, or a philosopher? Who do you go to besides the one that you love?
Well, the idea would be that you think these things through on your own. You come up with your best argument for a certain position, right? So the idea is that you raise a certain question, you pose certain answers, then maybe you and I get together and we discuss it, and we find that our answer has some problems, and we try again. So it's a process more than just a content. Like, you know, it's not like you can look in the answer book in philosophy and find out, should I really devote my life to being good to my neighbors, or should I devote my life to
building fences,
taking care of myself and my family, you know, which is a problem I mentioned early on with Socrates, right? So how much of my effort life should be geared towards helping others? Questions like that. So the idea would be that you reflect on it yourself and talk about it, and you develop this capacity to be critical of your own positions.
So who was that guy that looked in the pool of water and saw his own reflection?
Narcissus.
Yeah.
And narcissism is a word tossed around a lot today, isn't it?
Yeah. So do you have that particular part of your course? Or is that more...
We could ask, you know, when does, say, what's the difference between, say, taking good care of yourself and narcissism, you know, obsession with the self? Yeah, we talk a lot about the nature of the self. What's the self? What is the self? You know, that's a question of that's often brought up in philosophy under the rubric of personal identity theory. How do you since a person's body is changing all the time and their memories aren't continuous, what is the self? Is there a self there? You know, so
in your studies over the years and your professing over the years, do you think that yoga and deep meditation is the end to all ends, that you'll really discover yourself? Not a great question.
No, it's a little bit difficult because, for example, say Zen meditation, one of the goals would be to get over the idea that there is a self. So, say in the Buddhist tradition, as I understand it, the self is an illusion, and it's one of the illusions you want to get over. Right, to let go of that idea, this attachment to the self. So it really would depend a lot on the type of meditation, but also with respect to yoga, which has become quite an industry in our country. My mother was a yoga instructor in the 70s, which is very interesting, you know, back when this
was just... Was your mom a hippie?
No, not at all, but she got into yoga, and my father was like, this is crazy. You know, nobody was doing it back then. She taught a class at the Y, but I think so that... I worry sometimes that yoga in our society is, you know, yoga, the physical practice is supposed to be a preparation for the mental practice, and sometimes we just treat it as a fitness kind of thing, you know, which I guess is all right, but it's not the way yoga was meant, I don't think. It's supposed to be a mental practice. The physical practice is preparation for a certain kind of mindset.
I actually believe that yoga would be beneficial. I believe it would be.
We have great yoga resources in this town.
Yeah, we do.
Right nearby.
BYOM.
Yeah.
Bring your own mat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back with Dr. Marino in just a moment. But first...
Have you ever felt like your business has been tripped up by your bank? Friends in Bank & Trust understands how to be a financial resource for all types of small and large businesses and how to finance them. You might say that we are the best-kept secret in business banking. Friends in Bank & Trust, the bank that comes to play.
Contact your local Friends in Bank & Trust office at friendsinbank.com. That's FRANDSEN bank.com.
Member FDIC.
Graphic Mailbox means business. Our team of experts focuses on saving you time and money by ensuring you get the right products and services at the right price in a single quick visit. We can pack and ship almost anything to almost anywhere in the world. But shipping is only one way we can help make your life easier. In addition to our pack and ship service, we are also Northfield's one-stop shop for signs, banners, large format graphics, and multiple business services. Large or small, Graphic Mailbox can handle it. Come on in. We'll take care of you.
Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at
the Eagles? Doors?
Doors, no. It's like a one-hit wonder band.
Who's that?
You know what the name of the tune? You recognize it?
Oh, yeah. Who's that?
It's America.
Oh, is that right?
And it's called A Horse with No
Name. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was like the only hit there? One hit there?
Yeah. Not that I know of.
Yeah.
As I was doing that intro and all that, I was thinking that you've challenged me to keep the discussion on philosophy, and frankly, it's not really that easy. I just get to ask the questions. You give the answers, and I'm supposed to hopefully comprehend what your meaning is. So what would your prescription be if you were to have the opportunity to tell adults, not kids up at St. Mm-hmm. Olaf. I mean, yeah. Adults with a business career, let's say in their late 30s, early 40s, to be healthier mentally and therefore probably healthier physically based on the philosophy of...
Oh, so I make the case in this book that the study of existentialism will enhance your life because it'll help you to... deal with things like anxiety, depression, death. Yeah, so I think those are some, I think they're very valuable insights from those thinkers on those topics.
When I read your book,
and I'm going to send you a couple sample chapters.
Okay, and autographed?
Yeah, no, well, when it comes out, sure. You're proud
so
to.
Is it going to tell? Does it have a beginning, middle, and end, or mm-hmm. is it short stories all the way through?
No, it has just different topics. Yeah, it has a beginning, middle, and end. Yeah, and I start with some of the more difficult things and end up with faith and morals and so some of the more challenging emotions are the beginning of the book. How to deal with depression, anxiety, death.
And what age group are you looking to? I mean, they do marketing, right?
Yeah.
So how are you going to promote it? Who's your audience, for example?
I would say high school to 115.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. A broad audience like
so
that.
So you're going to have some printed in big print?
Yeah, right. That's
like
right.
Like the Reader's Digest?
I could use the big print, yeah.
Do they still have a Reader's Digest?
I don't know. I haven't seen it around. They used to be.
I used to like that.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I liked the short stories, the humor and uniform. Yeah. And
vocabulary test they had every time?
Yes. That was good. Absolutely.
They had good words, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ostensibly,
yeah, that's right.
Whatever that means. At 22 before 10 on KYMN Radio, my guest this morning is Gordon Marino. And Gordon, this is our third time that we've met and discussed at length philosophy. And I got to, for those that hadn't heard this before, I have to tell it. Your fellow philosopher at St. Olaf that passed away recently, Danish guy,
oh, Howard Hong?
Yeah, Howard Hong. Do you remember the story I told about him?
No, I don't.
Oh, well, maybe I didn't tell you, but if I did, you'll get
it. I'll tell you, yeah.
Okay. He lived in the same district that I lived in for, and I was an election judge. So I'd see him at every election, you know, and chit-chat with him. And one time it wasn't busy, and I asked him, I said, would you please... consider joining me on the Wayne Eddy Affair on the local radio station KYMN. He stopped and he paused. I'll think about it. To me, I don't know to this day whether he was joking or are you serious, because I thought it was perfect answer.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, but the pause too. He paused too, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. That's something you wouldn't get on email.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an example of something you wouldn't get on email.
So. And no, he never did join me on the air.
I'm a director of the Hong Kierkegaard Library, so I work very closely with him and his wife.
What's the deal about him? I people I know, they all think he's... All I know is his name sounds Oriental and has Danish roots.
It's Norwegian. Norwegian roots, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Well, no, so... He and his wife Edna, who's a poet, they translated all of Kierkegaard's works. It was amazing.
And who's he?
Howard Hong.
No, Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard is a famous existentialist, one of the greatest thinkers of all time. And we have at the college what's called the Hong Kierkegaard Library, where people from all over the world come to study his Kierkegaard, even people from Denmark, which is where Kierkegaard was from, because we have this tremendous collection that Howard and Edna gave in the Hong family gave to the college.
I'm getting confused. You said Norwegian, and I said Denmark, and now you're saying Denmark.
Well, Howard's the Hong family is originally from Norway, but Kierkegaard was Danish. But Norway was also part of Denmark until 1807, Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
So anyhow, but Howard studied Kierkegaard. Howard and Edna studied Kierkegaard.
So,
and then translated all his works while they were teaching and raising.
Translated from Norwegian to English?
No, translated from Danish to English.
Danish to English.
Yeah,
okay, that's where I'm getting the Dane. Okay.
Yeah.
So what's his point?
What's whose point, sir?
This guy that he translated.
Kierkegaard
or whatever his name.
Kierkegaard. Yeah, Kierkegaard.
What's his point?
So he's one of the he's one of the existentialists that are central in my book and in my life. He's talked about the meaning of anxiety, about faith, about all kinds of issues, right? But a beautiful writer, amazing writer, and a rigorous thinker, and so he's probably the most important figure in existentialism, which you should know about by now after our class here today, right? So he's an existential thinker. So Howard and Edna translated his works and made him available to the English-speaking world and very much increased Kierkegaard's popularity.
Well, is it at volumes and volumes?
22 volumes of published, 20-some volumes of published works, and Kierkegaard's, they also translated Kierkegaard's journals, so it's just a monumental task.
How long would it take a person to read everything?
Oh, yeah, to read everything, geez. I think we'll take a few, I mean, just to speed read right through. Months.
Okay.
And he wrote it all by hand, you know.
And those are originals are on display at St. Olaf?
Yeah, in the Hong Kierkegaard Library, yes. Yeah. We have a lot of Kierkegaard's books, in fact.
So I suppose
you should come up sometime. I'd love you to come up.
Well, I'd like to.
Yeah, yeah. Please come
I'd
up.
Like to sit in a class.
Yeah, anytime.
Just sit in the back and
let me know when you want to do it.
You can Tuesdays introduce me as your father.
Okay.
Father Eddie.
Why don't you do that?
Yeah, I would. What time are your
All
classes?
Right.
What time are your classes?
Tuesday and Thursday. I'll send you the times.
Well, I'm here from 9 to 11.
Okay, but I have a class in the afternoon, too.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Do you have handicap parking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Plenty of that, yeah.
Heck of a deal. That'd be fun.
Okay, you're on.
Go to the King's Room?
Yeah, that we could do that, but I think that closes.
I'm thinking of the old one.
What do you mean?
The old King's Room.
We still have the King's Room. It's the best, one of the best restaurants.
The one that when you're driving into the campus from on top of the hill, it's right in front of you?
Oh, no. Are you thinking of the Oly store?
No. The King's Room, you know where Brunstock is?
Bunrock.
Bunrock?
Yeah.
It's on your left as you're driving up?
Yeah, but the King's Room now is in Bunrock.
Yeah, well, before it used to be in the building straight ahead.
Yeah, right. Where the art building is now. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah,
I used to have a couple of foosball machines in the basement.
Did they really?
In the bowling alley.
Yeah. The King's Room's a great restaurant.
$0.10.
Is that right?
To play foosball. That was something. 16 before 11 o'clock on KYMN Radio. A lot of people listening right now may not have heard our first interview, and so I thought perhaps I can reintroduce you. You're from the East Coast.
I'm from the New Jersey Shore.
And we all associate that with partying.
Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, okay. That's the boss. Okay.
The boss, yeah.
All right. So you went to private schools, public schools?
I went to different schools.
How many schools did you go to?
Oh, probably, I think, 3 or 4. I got kicked out of school all the time.
I got kicked out, too.
I know. And I think we were bad boys. But we reformed.
Yes. Who'd ever think back in the 1950s for me, the late 50s, early 60s, and for you, the middle 60s, that we'd be sitting in a comfortable radio booth in a small town in Northfield, Minnesota, talking philosophy.
That's right.
I would have never guessed that.
That's right. So much of life is unpredictable. That's a philosophical point, right? And it's interesting when you're advising college students. You know, they always come in, they're thinking about their careers, and there's a part of me that wants to say, you know, that so much of it is up to who you bump into, all kinds of contingencies, and you can't just map out. It's, you know, people want control of their lives to map it out, and it doesn't work that way, right?
What does it mean, philosophically speaking, to love your job, your role in life? As opposed to, can't wait to get off work, hate to go tomorrow.
Well, I think for me that's always had a lot to do with the people I'm working with. For example, I've had, you know, used to work construction a lot and different jobs and moving jobs. And some jobs can be really not that pleasant, but if you're working with people that you like, it's great. On the other hand, I think there's a lot of people that are become sick in this world because they're in toxic environments. They're in jobs with a toxic supervisor. It seems to me that there are many people that just make small problems into big problems and torture each other. And so I think it's always had a lot to do with who you're working with, not just what you're. Also, if you're doing something that you feel is worthwhile, even moving jobs ahead, construction, whatever, you know, building roads. I think that's very important to be able to connect with your work. But even if you have a job that's boring or whatever, if you work with people that you care about and that you trust, that's great. But boy, there's a lot of people that are not in that situation.
Sounds like philosophy is relationships with yourself and others.
Well, that's our lives, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that's our lives, and we could. You know, there's a lot of thinking that goes on about to what extent social media has disrupted that. I don't think. I think people's interpersonal. This might be the old fogey in me, but I think interpersonal skills are on the decline. At least, you know.
I think you have new fogey.
New fogey.
I had the an opportunity to talk about a dear friend of mine, Danny Ayat, who used to own the Ole Cafe.
Yeah.
Years ago. He passed away last week, and
I'm sorry.
And in talking about him, he had a party. It was really cool. That's what he wanted, not a big funeral thing.
Yeah.
He wanted a party.
Uh-huh.
Had it at the Grand Theater, open mic.
Uh-huh.
And I talked about him being a risk taker.
Yeah.
And how much I admired people that were risk takers.
Right, me too.
And as I'm going through that thought right now, I'm looking at you with tenure. And me, with formerly owning this radio station, I didn't risk getting fired, but I risked losing the livelihood for many people.
Mm.
And I'm going, well, wait a minute. Where's your risk?
Mm.
If you like risk takers, what was your risk in life? Besides getting in the ring and getting pummeled.
Yeah. Depends what time of your my life you're talking about, but going into philosophy is a risk. I mean, and not to be compared with a lot of other risks that people take, because there's so few jobs, you know, and it's very, very difficult to get a PhD in philosophy, and when you do, there's hundreds and hundreds of applicants for the same position. That's a risk, especially when you have a family.
And what a thrill for you. When you got that doctorate degree. Mm. I mean, who'd ever thought it? And especially you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, that's a risk that you took, is spending all that time getting the education that would get you the doctorate degree, when you probably thought to yourself, I don't know about this, or did you just fall in love with it and excelled?
Well, yeah, a lot of people
knew it.
A lot of people, when they're going to graduate school, they don't think too much about the job market. At least back then, they weren't, you know. But I was just blessed to have some fantastic mentors, you know, and that's what I do my best to try to pass that on. I never would have been able to do it, half of what I'm doing without these tremendous mentors who went out of their way.
I'm going to take a final break this hour, and when we come back, let's talk about your book a little bit more.
Okay.
And talk about some challenging things in your life that you overcame. You were in the service, weren't you?
No. Uh-uh.
Not ROTC?
No, I taught at Virginia Military Institute.
Oh, that's where I'm getting
that. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
We will be back in just 1 minute.
Flexion Care Suites on the campus of Three Links here in Northfield offers comfort care in a home-like environment. We provide compassionate, specialized end-of-life care to residents and families during phases of an incurable illness. We have a wonderful staff that provides the highest quality of care, supporting each resident's personal wishes. I am Susan Samuelson, Clinical Nurse Manager of Reflections. You can call me at 664-8809 for a tour of this beautiful facility.
Millstream Commons Assisted Living, conveniently located in downtown Northfield, has got a big case of spring fever. Our tenants embrace life to the fullest, and one way of doing that is cheering on the Minnesota Twins. Sure, we've got beautiful apartments, great food, and all the supportive services needed, but another thing we get really excited about is baseball. To catch up on the latest Twins news and get a tour, call me, Kathy Olson, at 507-650-0141.
Sound familiar?
Oh, yeah, all good. No more Red to Fry, no more. Is that one more? No more. Oh, sorry.
Me and Mrs. Jones.
You've heard this before.
Oh, yeah, you're kidding me, sure.
Number 8 in the top pop. Is that in 1972.
So this is the top songs of that year?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. You've got number 10. Bill Withers, Lean on Me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was big, yeah.
And the song that I think should be changed into a Christmas song, Sammy Davis Jr. with The Candyman.
Dun, oh, yeah, I remember that, dun, yeah. Dun.
Yeah. And now we got Billy Paul with Me and Mrs. Jones at 8.
That was a movie, too.
Yeah. It's about heroin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mrs. Jones is heroin.
Yeah,
heroin.
Jones.
Mac Davis, Baby, Don't Get Hooked on Me.
Yeah.
America, a Horse with No Name. Johnny Nash and I Can See Clearly Now.
Yeah, yeah.
Harry Nilsson, Without You.
Yeah.
Then we played Gilbert O'Sullivan. And then the number one out of Motown, The First Time I Ever Saw Your Face by Roberta Flack.
Flack, yeah.
Mrs. Jones. Well, here we are with 8 minutes to go before it's time for our 15 with the author with Terry Knight, and my guest is looking forward to listening to that. So
that's for sure.
You're going to have to run to your car right away.
Yeah, I will. Okay. It's right out here.
Okay, here's the deal. I had a deal all worked up. What was it? Interesting chapters in your book, so we can go out and read it in depth. Some challenging things.
Yeah, again, how to deal with, I dealt with a lot of depression in my life,
What is depression? Do you sleep in bed all day long?
Well, you could, or you could, it's a inexplicable sadness, you know, that you just feel overwhelming, can be paralyzing sometimes.
Over a lost dog? And I'm not being smart.
By inexplicable sadness, I mean, sometimes it's a sadness you can't point to one thing as this is why I'm depressed, you know, this is why I'm down, you know. A feeling of loss, and sometimes it manifests itself as a feeling like nothing matters, you know, and so it can be. And in the book, I talk about some experiences of that, but also about the idea that, at one level, we have feelings at one level, but then at another level, we have this ability to relate ourselves to our feelings. That is, so I can take this, I might be severely depressed and kind of give up on trying to be a good and kind person, or I could say, yeah, I'm really depressed, I'm really down, but I'm going to try to reach through that pain.
How long does something like that last in your case?
Wow, a long time. And
years, months, weeks?
Yeah, pretty much chronic with it, yeah, from my whole life.
Wow.
A lot of.
Do you look in the mirror in disgust?
Sometimes when I get up, my ears are messy.
No, yeah. I mean, when you're going through that, you literally look in a mirror and say, look at me.
No,
I'm unworthy or whatever.
Yeah, or just, I mean, sometimes it has to do with, it's kind of like grief in the sense of just feeling so, just sad all the time and just feeling like life is hell, you know? And there's been a lot of sickness in my family.
A lot of what?
Sickness in my family, okay. And that's certainly exacerbated that sense of this place is, the world is a veil of tears, you know? And that's also an insight you get. I mean, St. Paul talks about the groaning of existence, Buddhist tradition, suffering. And so there's a lot of I really respect authors who are able to deal with that aspect of life, think of life as walking through the fire, you know, and trying to do it with kindness and dignity. But there's so much denial of what's going on in life, I think, a lot of time. And that's one of the reasons I was attracted to existentialism, as I think these authors address these painful things, anxiety.
For those of you that just tuned in, my guest this morning is, you missed a good show, but it's online at kymnradio.net. Go to our website and just look up Gordon Marino.
Or they could email me at Stanhoff if they have any questions.
Yeah, they could. Once again, that word,
existentialism.
Existentialism. Existentialism.
That's it.
Okay. It is the feeling of...
It's a certain philosophical and literary movement, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like a religion?
No, not like a religion at all. No, it's a philosophy. No. And it includes thinkers like Kierkegaard, Sartre, Camus, but also writers like Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Kafka. So it's quite a hodgepodge of thinker-writers.
Tolstoy?
Yeah, he was next. Yeah. Death of Ivan Illich, one of his greatest stories.
How about Crime and Punishment?
Yeah.
Okay. I told my English teacher that my book report was going to be on Crime and Punishment, and I showed him the book, and he said, "Wow, I'm impressed." And then I started reading it.
And what happened?
I put it back in the shelf and went and got a different book. Gee.
Yeah, it takes a while to get into that book.
I was 17, I think, at the time. I had no idea. I thought it was going to be about Crime and Punishment.
It is.
Well,
ultimately.
But I mean, you know what I mean. Cops and robbers and all that.
Yeah. That's right.
So I want to end up on the note that we do respect the fact that we have had a grand opportunity to discuss philosophy.
Yeah.
And you're always welcome back.
Thank you very much.
If you've got some ideas that you want to express that people like myself can learn from go over my head.
But we also made an agreement that you're going to come up and come to a class. And
yeah, I want
visit.
To.
I think it'd be fun.
I want to.
Yeah.
I'll tell you about a class I did with a guy from Carleton College.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty interesting, I think. Let's get back to boxing just for the heck
of
it. We have. Did you notice how grammar is suffering in this world today?
Yes.
And I'm picking up on it.
Yes.
And I'm embarrassed. Where is boxing today? I mean.
It always goes through periods of ups and downs. It always has to have.
It's been down.
Yeah, it is. I mean, after Floyd Mayweather, boxing's always required this a fighter that can reach out to the casual fan. So whether it be Floyd Mayweather, Mike Tyson, De La Hoya, Ali, and right now there isn't that one figure that can bring in the person who doesn't watch other fights. But it's on a regular network now too. So they're getting some pretty decent numbers. So boxing's up and down. It's not gonna die.
So what do you think of caged fighting?
I don't like. I've actually trained one person who was pretty successful at it, and I don't like the aesthetic of it. It seems to me more like a street fight. But that's just me. You know, it involves great technique and courage and a lot of the elements of boxing. But it's. The spirit of it seems to me like something in the parking lot, you know. So,
have you ever heard of the Sod Buster?
Is that a wrestler?
Yes.
Yeah, I think I have heard of it.
He boxed Muhammad Ali in Chicago.
Oh yeah.
I had him on the show here.
Did you?
Not Muhammad, but the Sod Buster.
What did the Sod Buster say about that experience?
Oh, he said it was one hell of an experience, and he would do it over again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he made a few bucks.
I'll bet you did.
You know, and it was pretty much, if I remember correctly, the outcome was. Pretty obvious, you know, when Cassius Clay.
Yeah, but I'm sure he took it easy on him.
Yeah. So have you yourself ever gained any title as a in-the-ring boxer?
No.
Always a coach, never a fighter?
No, I was a fighter, but I wasn't at that level. And
what weight did you
Heavyweight, fight? Because when I was boxing, there was no cruiserweight. So cruiserweight was anything above 178. So in my generation... Heavyweights were...
Did you ever knock anybody out?
Yeah.
Did you ever get knocked out?
I got knocked down a couple times.
Okay, see, we've got more to talk about when you come back.
That's right, and I've had many concussions, so...
Okay, well, I am going to take a break for the news coming up next. Not the news, excuse me. 15 with the author with Terry Knight.
You
want to hear this one.
I don't want to hear that.
Okay, I'll push a few buttons here. I'm waiting for...
Thanks a lot. Thanks so much for having me on, Wayne. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's always a blast.
You're really fun to talk with.
And I'm looking forward to see you down at Howard's, all right?
Okay, all right.
KYMN, Northfield, Minnesota, a friend you can count on, 1080 on your AM dial for nearly 50 years, and 95.1 FM, The One.
It's time for 15 with the Author, hosted by Terry Knight. Join Terry as she opens the cover on a different book each week and talks with the author about their book, their life, and their message. Take a deeper look under the cover with Terry.
Everyone has a story. Not every story, however, is told. Family stories, sometimes handed down through generations, sometimes buried with those who lived with them. Today's story is about a woman learning a horrifying family truth and a plea to tell the world. Through Providence, I met Lauren M. Haupt, who told a compelling story of her grandfather. After sharing the abbreviated version, I told her about 15 with the author. I invited Lauren on the show today to talk about her journey in writing the book of her family story. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi there. How are you?
I am well, thank you. It's a beautiful sunny day here, so enjoying that. This is a different kind of 15 with the author, as there is no completed book. But the story you have to tell is really compelling, and I am hopeful that this encourages others who have a story, real or imagined, to move forward and write it. And
yes, absolutely.
This is, you were visiting your grandfather. We're going to talk about the book and how you got started, and then we'll talk about the different steps you've taken so far. But